Let's recall instead Chris Hedges' recollections of the end of the Soviet Empire in East Germany.
What terrifies the state most is that the foot soldiers that are tasked with using coercion to keep us in check defect. Yeah. And the way that we make them defect is by stating a truth that they understand. When I, a couple years ago, with 133 veterans, mostly from Iraq and Afghanistan, were arrested on the White House fence protesting the wars there, when we were cuffed, it turns out that most of those police were in the National Guard and were in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they were whispering in our ears, keep protesting. The state is terrified of that. And I think one of the major reasons they passed Section 1021 of the NDAA is because they don't trust, ultimately, the police to protect them. And we saw it in Zuccotti. So the whole demeanor of the blue-uniformed police changed when the white shirts, the officers, were there. There's a YouTube clip of me in Zuccotti telling people not to taunt the police. I'm not justifying what the police do. I'm not. I'm trying to find a mechanism to destroy the system. And while, you know, many of these cops or many of these COs are without question sadists, there's no question. We need to reach at least a segment of them who are not, because it creates paralysis within the system, which is our goal. It is by appealing to the conscience of those who are in the structures of power, who see that they are defending and enabling a rapacious and unjust, a discredited elite, that we have the capacity to win. And in that sense, we live in what Berkman calls an invisible revolution, or what Gramsci calls an interregnum, a moment when the efficacy of the old ideas, neoliberalism, have lost their hold on the popular imagination. Congress has an approval rating of 7%, but we have yet to formulate a vision to take its place. But when we do, and I speak as a socialist, then we become powerful. And Berkman says it's like a pot that's coming to boil. You don't see it boiling, but then you suddenly hear the whistle and see the steam. And that was true in every revolution I covered, including East Germany and Czechoslovakia. It unraveled at an incredibly... So the facade appears totally intact, the Stasi state. And then it just crumbles like a sandcastle.
522.
There's a deep spiritual crisis in people's lives, and that it is rooted in, number one, the deprivation of the desire for meaning and purpose in the world of work. And people are deprived of the capacity to use their time in a way that connects to some higher meaning and purpose. Now, this is astounding to us because we didn't realize, coming from a kind of academic or intellectual or progressive background, we always sort of had this prejudice that we were on a higher level, and that most working people were as just concerned about money. And summed up by James Carville, who said, it's the economy, stupid. But what we were learning from people was that there was a hunger for something much more than that, that people really felt deprived of a capacity to use their life connect to higher meaning and purpose. So that was one level of a spiritual crisis, that people felt like their lives were being wasted all day in the world of work because the bottom line was money and power, and they were learning day after day that if they did not spend all of their time and energy maximizing money and power for their corporation or for wherever they were working, they were going to get downsized out of a job. But then on the other hand, the other thing they were learning at the world of work is just to look at other people from the framework of what can you be of use to me, and internalizing a consciousness about other people basically says, I have to look out for number one. Nobody else is going to take care of me. So it's a kind of utilitarian framework in which you see other people through the frame of what can you do for me. But then people bring that home into personal life, and they feel surrounded by other people who have learned the rationality of the marketplace in which everybody is looking out for number one. And as a result of that, relationships start to become much weaker people feel they're surrounded by people who only care about themselves, and they feel misrecognized. Nobody really sees who they are. Instead, they are only seen through the framework of, what can this person do for this other person? In other words, nobody sees who I really am, is what people were telling me. They're saying, even my kids only look at me from the standpoint of what I can do for them. Even my spouse looks at me from the standpoint of what can I do for her or for him. So people are feeling increasingly lonely, even in their marriages, even in their family life, and scared that even those relationships may quickly collapse, because in a society in which everybody's looking out for number one, you have very little certainty that your own spouse won't at some point find somebody who they think could satisfy more of their needs than you can, and then because they're a rational maximizer of self-interest that is looking out for number one, they're going to leave you and go to this next person. So there's a tremendous amount of fear and upset about living in a society where there's so much selfishness and materialism.
About a quarter century ago, when I was living in the UK, I became incensed at the waste that resulted from advertising, from the machine to get inside people's heads and motivate them to buy stuff they otherwise wouldn't have bought. And I thought, well, what can I, as one person, do? I thought, well, I'm going to boycott advertising, and I did. For at least a year, I didn't buy anything at all that was advertised. So it got to the point where it was a real downer if I accidentally saw an advert for something that's now, oh, I'm not going to buy that. And you can say, well, Robin, you failed because you didn't bring down capitalism. But that wasn't the point. The point was that I wanted to do something that was a step in the right direction. And if everybody had a similar inspiration, people would quickly have realized these adverts aren't working. We won't advertise. It turned out it was actually a very healthy time for me, both body and soul, because I didn't have any confectionery. It's all advertised. I realized that the healthiest products are the least advertised products. I ate simple staple foods. I ate quite a lot of oats and things. It was cheap. It was not processed food. And this is what Ivan Illich is talking about. This is from CBC podcast, The Decline of Friendship and the Corruption of Christianity.
The certainty that I can get along without is one of the most efficacious ways of convincing yourself, no matter where you stand on the intellectual or emotional ladder, that you are free. Renunciation, self-imposed limits, are the basis for a practice that prepares people, perhaps even politically, to discuss what kind of limits do we want to impose on ourselves as a group of 2, 5, 12 friends, or perhaps as a neighborhood. Realizing that we can do that, realizing that we can practice renunciation, I have seen, I can witness to it for the last 15 or 20 years, is for many people who suffer from great fears and sense of impotence and depersonalization, a very simple way back to a self which stands above the constraints of the world.
642.
It would be some advantage to live a primitive and frontier life, though in the midst of an outward civilization, if only to learn what are the gross necessaries of life.
A contemporary practice of renunciation, Illich says, is the opposite of mortification or asceticism or any of the other terms one might associate with ideologically founded self-denial. Rather, it is a precondition for enjoyment, for a sober joy in those things within my personal reach. By renunciation, we open ourselves to what Illich calls gratuity, the spirit in which we receive a gift. And it is in this spirit of praise and thanksgiving, he says, that he hopes to live.
Now, this was such a crowded show up to now. Let's keep a quiet corner for some self-reflection about what might be applicable as a step towards the world that we want to live in. This is Alan Watts speaking from episode 735.
Basically, what I really want is what you want. And I don't know what you want. Surprise me.
That's the kinship between I and thou. So when I ask, I go right down to the question, which we started with. What do I want? The answer is, I don't know. When Bodhidharma was asked, who are you? Which is another form of the same question. He said, I don't know. Planting flowers to which the butterflies come. Bodhidharma says, I know not. I don't know what I want. But when you don't know what you want, you've reached the state of desirelessness. When you really don't know. You see, there's a beginning stage of not knowing and there's an ending stage of not knowing. In the beginning stage, you don't know what you want because you haven't thought about it, or you've only thought superficially. Then when somebody forces you to think about it and go through and say, yeah, I think I'd like this, I think I'd like that, I think I'd like the other, that's the middle stage. Then you get beyond that, say, is that what I really want? In the end you say, no, I don't think that's it. I might be satisfied with it for a while, and I wouldn't turn my nose up at it. But it's not really what I want. Why don't you really know what you want? Two reasons that you don't really know what you want. Number one, you have it. Number two, you don't know yourself, because you never can. The Godhead is never an object of its own knowledge. Just as a knife doesn't cut itself, fire doesn't burn itself, light doesn't illumine itself. It's always an endless mystery to itself. I don't know. And this I don't know, uttered in the infinite interior of the spirit, this I don't know, is the same thing as I love, I let go, I don't try to force or control. It's the same thing as humility. And so the Upanishads say, if you think that you understand Brahman, you do not understand. And you have yet to be instructed further. If you know that you do not understand, then you truly understand. For the Brahman is unknown to those who know it, and known to those who know it not. And the principle is that any time you, as it were, voluntarily let up control, in other words, cease to cling to yourself, you have an access of power. Because you're wasting energy all the time in self-defense, trying to manage things, trying to force things to conform to your will. The moment you stop doing that, that wasted energy is available. And therefore, you are, in that sense, having that energy available, you are one with the divine principle. You have the energy. When you're trying, however, to act as if you were God, that is to say, you don't trust anybody and you're the dictator and you have to keep everybody in line, you lose the divine energy. Because what you're doing is simply defending yourself. So then, the principle is, the more you give it away, the more it comes back. Now you say, I don't have the courage to give it away. I'm afraid. And you can only overcome that by realizing, you better give it away, because there's no way of holding on to it. The meaning of the fact, you see, that everything is dissolving constantly, that we're all falling apart, we're all in a process of constant death, and that the worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes, or it prospers, and like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little hour or two is gone, you know, all that Omar Khayyam jazz. You know, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the great globe itself, I, all which it inherits, shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. All falling apart. Everything is. That's the great assistance to you. See, that fact that everything is in decay is your helper. That is allowing you that you don't have to let go because there's nothing to hold on to. It's achieved for you, in other words, by the process of nature. So once you see that you just don't have a prayer, and it's all washed up, and that you will vanish and leave not a rack behind, and you really get with that, suddenly you find you have the power, this enormous access of energy. But it's not power that came to you because you grabbed it. It came in entirely the opposite way. And power that comes to you in that opposite way is power with which you can be trusted.
Now, for a more conventional take on possible steps, let's hear Bill Davis from the Christic Institute.
So basically, it's a matter of we get more informed about this, talk about it with other people, and whoever you are, whatever you are, let this be an extension of what you are.
Educate, organize, use your own talents so that it's an extension of what you are. If you're a filmmaker, make films about it, you know? The one thing absolutely that I think we need to be wary of in this country is the attitude that says, oh, there's nothing you can do. As long as that's around, these people will succeed. And they deliberately try, I think, to get that attitude accepted. I've never accepted the notion that there's nothing you can do about it. And one of the things that intrigues me is that I run into people in places like El Salvador, people with very little education, people who make less than $100 a year. They're not saying there's nothing I can do. They're filled with hope and creativity, and they see themselves as the actors of history and not just the objects of it anymore. And that's exciting. So, you know, if they can find a way to do something about it with so little by way of resources, I mean, what's our excuse? We've got all kinds of resources, educational and material and otherwise. So there's always something that everyone can do. And another aspect of it too is that it may not seem like much, you know, but if you grab a loose thread on the edge of a tapestry, pull on that thread, who knows where it will take you into which parts of the picture. The first thing you know, you will see a different piece of the puzzle that you haven't seen before. So, but it's important to grab onto a thread somewhere, you know, any kind of a thread, any kind of injustice, be it local or global, and work on it, and study it, and analyze it, and see how it's a microcosm of the bigger picture. And there is always something we can do that everybody can do.
Well, amen to that. Remember, in the real world, poor people have as much strength and power as rich people. Well, perhaps a bit more if they're used to doing work, as opposed to pressing buttons or signing checks. So, now for some deeper insights into the millennia-long process which has led us to the 21st century, this is Marvin Bram from episode 537.
Around 45,000 years ago, there had been Homo sapiens for a long time before that, as we know. People precisely like us, genetically identical to us, lived in pleasant parts of the earth in different ways, in bands that we've all heard about and in villages. Until around 6,000 years ago, something happened so profound that we might as well have had a species change 6,000 years ago. We think, or they think, that we like to be in groups of around 30, 35 people who have known us since we were born, and as people are born into it, we know them until we die, a clan. And when clans got together, if they settled down because some people decided that if you wait around while you plant part of a plant, the rest of it will come up and you'll eat well and have a bigger family. If you do that, which happened about 10, 12, 15,000 years ago, then these groups of 30, 35 would get together into those villages of 300 or 400. But if they got too big, they'd schism. They would break into, like mitosis, into a daughter village. They didn't just get bigger and bigger. What what had been mixed in Sumer between 5 and 6,000 years ago was, in my research, for the first time sorted out into pure cultures of Unavasu. I use cultures here in a kind of pharmacological way. As far as I can tell, for the first time around that time and around here, what has been mixed and, so to speak, proximate, because I want to make a metaphor of distance, mixed and proximate became sorted out and distanced in such a way that it might not be possible to see down here from here. Well, most of the time you could. If you were up here, you might remember what it was down here. You might have kids, you see your two-year-old behaving a certain way, and if the doors are closed and your spouse isn't in the room, you behave that way too. You could remember what it was. The question then must be asked, can the distance between pure cultures of Univocity and Felicity ever become so great that the one becomes invisible to the other? And this part of the human condition is universally believed to be the whole of it. And the answer is sure. It's happened. It's happened in the last century.
And that was a new insight for me. I'm used to thinking of the empires, people in Europe, commanding military hierarchies. I'm not used to thinking about how differently they understand the world. Marvin Bram's observations here help me to understand the crescendo of violence in the modern world. This huge effort to direct technology, not to feeding, clothing, and helping those of the world who are sometimes literally starved of material goods, but to try to make everything controllable and directable from a single HQ. Marvin Bram is reminding us, is Western culture so unifical, so abstracted, rectangular, and based on dry, unifical understanding of the world, that the people have forgotten what it is to be a living, breathing human being on the planet, aware of multiple simultaneous meanings and relationships and roles? How ironic it would be if the information control grid designed to capture all that data were somehow to be subverted and turned into a neural system for the world, a means whereby people can directly feel one another's pain and joy, a system that could not have them staring at screens but alert them to the excitement of the real world. If we can have something parallel to a species change 6,000 years ago, well, that sounds quite exciting. What about a species change now? Nobody said that species changes had to be predictable. I suggest, rather than call ourselves Homo sapiens sapiens, that most knowledgeable of Homo, could we perhaps have a subspecies change to, say, Homo sapiens amarens, the loving variety of the knowledgeable man? I'm not casting knowledge, I'm not casting the left brain adrift, just pointing out that logic, reason, and unifical, left-centered, clear thinking, if we don't understand, if we're disembodied, lifeless, abstracted, and screened off from the world, that's a bit of an empty concept. So how about a new name for a new rationale and a new behavior pattern? For more inspiration on this, let's hear from Charles Eisenstein. This is new material to the show. It's the soundtrack of a video in which he's speaking on exiting the Matrix.
If you are in this process of breakdown and not knowing who you are and the way the world is and watching the old certainties dissolve into mystery, and what you thought you knew dissolve into wow, that was just a story. If that's happening to you, like, that's okay. It goes counter to our training to be in a state of not knowing. You get in trouble in school if you don't know the answer. You're supposed to know the answer. You're supposed to have things under control. You're supposed to have a plan. You're supposed to have measurable outcomes, objectives. But if you attempt to construct those when you're in this space between stories, when you're in this time of breakdown, then you're going to end up erecting some version of what you already had before. And you won't be even that excited about it. And you won't be able to achieve it anyway. It'll seem phony. So I'd like to encourage you to abide in that space of unknowing for a while, until a new story comes to you that really resonates with who you want to become, that isn't preying on your fear, but that is inviting you into service to something that's really beautiful to you. And I'm not even saying you'll recognize it right away. Probably you'll have to have a few false starts. Now, even though I'm not offering here's the new story, I can say a little bit maybe about some of the general qualities of the new story, or maybe the meta story, which is what I use Thich Nhat Hanh's word for interbeing, that says that self and world are not separate, that what I do to the world comes back to me, that my purpose here is to give to something greater than myself, that I'm part of a larger whole, that this is my basic nature.
In order to prevail against what seems like overwhelming odds, the movement must escape entirely from the matrix, and it must bring the rest of society with it. As long as the matrix exists, humanity cannot be free.
As I spent less time online and looking at screens, I've been trying to learn bird language, and this is one of the stories which inspired me to do so.
He observed once a whole line of African elephants moving through the country, and he noticed that a little plover came out of its nest and began to drag its wing like it was injured, and it made all kinds of noise and kept flying up in the face of this great matriarch elephant that was leading the herd. And they were headed, their trajectory was right through that bird's nest. And so the bird was having a heart attack, more or less, flying up at this elephant, flying up the elephant, and this elephant leading, you know, a couple of dozen other elephants behind it, had absolutely no reason to listen to this plover. I mean, if you think that animals are selfish and that's all they think about, this really illustrates what Ingwe calls, you know, the whole etiquette of the wilderness, that these animals all really respected each other when it was possible. And what happened was that lead elephant brought her ears forward, grumbled a little bit with this low rumbling sound, and kind of swung her head from side to side and studied the landscape in front of her, spotted the nest, realized what was going on, and then gave a certain call, and then actually detoured all the elephants around that plover nest. So all the elephants actually went around that nest because the plover more or less requested them to stop and go around. And that shows you the kind of etiquette that is out there among the animals in times of peace, if you will, that they do really respect each other's space. And you have to understand that we can't, A, assume that birds are so dumb that they'll never recognize individuals, and B, that there isn't some kind of honor and respect among these animals, even in between species. It is hunter and hunted, for sure. That is a big part of the story. But during baseline, etiquette really does play a role here.
As an antidote to so much logical left-brain thinking and European male speaking, this is new material to the show. It's called Women Speak of Lands and Others, Part 2. And I shall link it in from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/750.
Carol Crow, an Algonquin biologist I know, was going to a conference on sustainable development, and the elders in her community asked her what that was. She offered the standard definitions of sustainability: a means of consuming the resources of the earth in such a way that we do not impair the ability of the earth to provide the same resources to future generations. Sounds good, right? Her elders were very quiet. And finally, one of them said, "That sounds to me like they just want to keep on taking from the earth. Don't they understand that you can't just take? You go to that conference and you tell them that in the way of our people, the first thing we think of should be what can we give. I was taught to reciprocate berries with a gift of my own. It might be leaving a gift of honor or a gift of care, like scattering the seeds or planting the little ones back in the ground so that the plants will flourish after the harvest. I would add one more thing to this list. Defend them fiercely. Love them so much, you will not let them be lost. This is how we pick berries. This is how indigenous environmental philosophy deals with the question of what is our responsibility in return for the gifts of the earth. And I ask you to consider these teachings from the berries and carry them beyond the berry patch. Imagine social, political, economic decision-making based on the honorable harvest. Imagine a land developer, I like to do this, eyeing a prime parcel of woodland for a housing development. What if he had to ask permission of the forest before converting it to pavement? What if he had to abide by their answer? What if he were mandated to take only what was needed and to give something back in return? We have chosen the policies that we live by. And we can choose again. I'm told that there is an even older teaching, older and more fundamental than take only what you need, and it's take only that which is given to you. Think about it. We already know this. We would not walk into our grandmother's house and start rifling through her cupboards looking for cookies and just take what we want. That would be unthinkable. We wait until she offers us cookies on her favorite china plate. And yet, as a society, we take indiscriminately from the earth whatever we want. We live in the house of Grandmother Earth. We should behave accordingly. Take only that which is given to us is a pretty challenging ethical and practical problem. Some things seem obvious. Berries clearly give themselves to us. With lures of sweetness and color, they beg us to pick them. And by eating them up and dispersing their seeds, we are returning the gift. Both berries and berry pickers benefit by the transaction. They remind us that all flourishing is mutual. And if berries can evolve systems of reciprocity, why not us? Can we extend the concept of the honorable harvest to address the environmental challenges that we face today? Coal from mountaintop removal, that is not given to us. Tar sands oil that destroy the land is not given to us. Shale gas from hydrofracking that poisons water so we can have more things to throw away is clearly not given to us. But the sun's energy is given to us every day. Every day the wind blows and the surf rolls. These are given to us freely and limitless in supply, although not without their own cost. Take only that which is given could be a key part of a sustainable energy policy. We human people have a moral obligation to the future, to our grandchildren, and to the earth herself. And that obligation seems so difficult to exercise when we're made to feel powerless by the actions of multinational corporations, big money, unresponsive political systems. But you and I, we are not powerless. The teachings of the honorable harvest did not disappear with the buffalo. They're even more compelling now as then. We may not be able to directly stop a mining company or the poisoners of water, but we do have control over our own honor. We can reclaim the ethic of the honorable harvest. We can choose to ask permission and listen to the answer. We can choose to take only what we need, and to use respectfully whatever we have taken. we can choose not to consume things which are dishonorably harvested. We can follow the lead of the berries and demand that our economic system be aligned with ecological laws and human values. We could choose to be grateful recipients instead of mindless thieves. And in this way, you and I together can live with honor and sustain the lives of those that sustain ours.
Can we reimagine ourselves in place in a different way of being in the world, still holding on to the essentials of what we love and what we will fight for, land health, wildness, a livable future? We know that our institutions are no longer serving us. We have the opportunity to reimagine ourselves in the 21st century. Our governments, our schools, our religious institutions, even ourselves, especially ourselves, to imagine, reimagine, recompose ourselves in place, deeply rooted, deeply engaged, brave, home. It is time for us to return home.
Nature and human life are as various as our several constitutions. Who shall say what prospect life offers to another?
And I used to work actively in the field of restoration ecology. Until after spending time with wounded landscapes, as all of us do, I began to understand again, I began to remember that it's not the land that's broken. It's our relationship to land that's broken, which is why we propagate these wounded sites all over the landscape over and over again. And so I began to rethink my work as a restoration ecologist to be thinking about healing our relationship to land. And scientific tools have such great power for healing or for engaging, restoring ecosystem structure and function. But I think that it's the language of the heart and of the spirit, which are present in traditional ecological knowledge and indigenous knowledge, that have some of the power to heal that relationship. I also want to say that when I speak of the indigenous worldview, it's really an organic worldview. It's the worldview of people who are close to the land, who listen to the land, who understand the world as gift and are fed by that land. A good colleague of mine says that we shouldn't be calling it indigenous knowledge. We should be calling it naturalized knowledge, the knowledge of natural people, because we are all indigenous to some place and hope to be indigenous to the place that we live, to live as if we were indigenous. I don't think that we need to fix other species. I think the species we need to fix is ourselves. The loneliness that we need to address is our own, our species' loneliness. When we have isolated ourselves from the knowledge of our non-human teachers, the regard of our more-than-human kinfolk.
How do you think of hope when we're wrestling with these large questions?
I think it's easy to feel despair when you do pay attention to the living world and see all of those losses. But despair is a way of accepting powerlessness. And I think that we have to engage hope. And one of the links, I think, between despair and engaging hope and moving forward is actually grief. to look at those wounds of the world and really feel them. Native peoples with a great history of loss on Turtle Island, are cultures which are familiar with the grief of loss of that living world, but that grief opens the door to healing. I think you have to really feel it in order to recognize how much you would miss what you love when it's gone. And we take so much for granted, and we don't miss it until we don't have it anymore. But to really feel that grief, to feel the love that you have for a place, I think can also propel hope. And I think that one of the most powerful things that does impel hope and impel our work to the future is putting your hands in the ground, is recognizing that while our leaders may not be leading, we can lead. And if our leaders won't do the right thing, we have to do the right thing. And that we as individuals, we as a collective, can kind of reclaim our own honor about the way that we take from the earth and what we give to the earth. And that creates a movement. And I have a lot of faith in my neighbors, both human and non. But not to sit back, to act out of that love, to act out of that grief, and say that I will fiercely defend everything that's left to me. And to me, that's where my hope comes from. I think people will do that. They already are.
Peace Pilgrim from 609.
After 25,000 miles, she stopped counting, but kept walking, focusing on an increasingly full schedule of speaking appearances in schools, churches, colleges, and on radio and television.
642.
Could a greater miracle take place than for us to look through each other's eyes for an instant? 'Live in all the ages of the world in an hour. Aye, in all the worlds of the ages. History, poetry, mythology. I know of no reading of another's experience so startling and informing as this would be.
In the Potawatomi language, we call these beautiful berries Odemen, the heartberry. We acknowledge them as the leaders of the berry people, for they're the first to give us their fruits in the summer. In the language I was born to, we call them strawberries. And in the language I've learned as a scientist, we call them by the Latin binomial Fragaria virginiana. And in all three languages, they are so sweet. I'm a scientist, a plant ecologist, and also a student, just a beginner, of our traditional teachings. My understanding of the world lies at the intersection of two great ways of knowing, between science and indigenous knowledge. And in scientific ways of thinking, these berries are the reproductive structures of a distinct species, a vital component of the food web. In indigenous ways of thinking, we recognize them as the berry people, who are persons, non-human persons, with their own intrinsic roles in the democracy of species. These are sovereign beings with their own intelligences, their own wisdom, their own responsibilities. Berries, as persons, in some nations, as you know, the rights of all species are enshrined in the Constitution because they are people. In U.S. law, corporations are granted the status of people, while berries are without any right at all. I ask you, what corporation gives you wild strawberries on a summer morning? By any measure, when you put one in your mouth, you know that wild strawberries are a gift, all wrapped in red and green. The natural world is a source of gifts, not commodities, but gifts. Berries are given to us by the plants themselves. In fact, in our language, the Potawatomi word for berry, min, is very closely related to our word for giving gifts, minidawag. Giving a gift is to be as a berry. How we think about our relationship to the living world matters deeply. It is our moral imagination that will shape our futures as much as any technology or policy. When something is understood as a gift instead of a commodity, a door opens. An opening to the potential for reciprocity. And much of mainstream culture has chosen to see the earth as property. But we could choose differently. We, you and I together, we could choose to live in a world made of gifts. And as human people, we are showered daily with gifts from Shakmakwe, Mother Earth. And the question we face as non-photosynthetic, lamentably, beings is how do we respond to the gifts of the Earth? How can we be ecological consumers, as we must, in a way that honors those gifts? We have only to look around us at the wounds we have inflicted on the Earth to know that we don't yet have that answer. And where will we find a teacher for this most pressing question of our time, when our actions have brought creation to the brink of a massive wave of extinction, when we stand at the edge of a climate precipice? And in my culture, plants are known not only as people, but as our teachers, our oldest teachers. After all, they've been here far longer than we have. They know how to fulfill their responsibilities, while we human people are still trying to figure it out. They know how to build soil, recycle water, create homes for endless other beings. They give us the very air we breathe. They know how to make berries out of light. We might do well to listen. And if berries are our teachers, what are they telling us? In our ceremonies, we honor the berries by passing them in a bowl for everybody in the circle to share. And they remind us of the teachings known as the one bowl, one spoon, that the earth is as one bowl, filled with everything that we need. A bowl with finite capacity. When it's empty, it's empty. And there's just one spoon, the same one for all of us. For humans and for the more than humans alike. There cannot be a teaspoon for some people and a power shovel for others. So say the berries.
I think that we may safely trust a good deal more than we do. We may waive just so much care of ourselves as we honestly bestow elsewhere. Nature is as well adapted to our weakness as to our strength. The incessant anxiety and strain of some is a well-nigh incurable form of disease.
735.
It's this obsession with individualism, this assertion that we are first and foremost separate, that we're trying to challenge.
609.
Before a life can be in harmony, it must be in harmony with its part in God's plan. You know, every one of us has a unique part in God's plan, which we cannot learn from without, which we must learn from within. And therefore, if you do not yet know clearly where you fit into God's plan, seek it in receptive silence. Of a feeling of deep seeking for a meaningful way of life, I began to walk one night through the woods with the feeling that I would continue to walk until I found what I was seeking. And after I had walked almost all night, I came out into a clearing where the moonlight was shining down. And I found myself saying, if you can use me for anything, please use me. And I found myself feeling, here I am, take all of me. Use me as you will, I withhold nothing. And then, of course, I felt I had found what I was seeking. I experienced the complete willingness, without any reservations whatsoever, to give my life to something beyond myself.
I'm convinced we ought to get on the right side of the world revolution. We as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin to shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society, when machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people. Giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered. True revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will be only an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be changed, so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway.
I always thought that when the time came to do the right thing in a big way, that I would always be the one that stood up and did the right thing.
True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious.
True revolution of values will soon look uneasy on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation.
Makes you so sick at heart.
Now is the time
that you can't take part
to make real the promises of democracy.
You can't even passively take part.
Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time.
And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers.
To lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time.
Upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop.
To make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment.
And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Now is the time. 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 Now is the time.
743.
The way of love without power. Free, self-giving love that meets no need and expects no guarantee.
In nature's economy, the currency is not money, it is life.
We cannot help but renounce power, not because of a Gandhian or Christian spirit of renunciation to violence, but because the power which we sought 10 or 20 years ago reveals its own void, its own illusory characteristics.
This is a beautiful day. It is a new day. We are together. We are unified and on one accord. Because together we got power. Apart we got power. Today on this program you will hear gospel and rhythm and blues and jazz. We know that music is music.
I'm not in despair. I haven't lost faith. because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. This faith, we will be able to speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when the lion and the lamb will lie down together, and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid, because the words of the Lord have spoken it. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all over the world we will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual. Free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last with this faith. We'll sing it as we're getting ready to sing it now. Men will beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nations will not rise up against nations, neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
Living with an obsession for security is to condemn yourself to being a slave to a machine and to the social relations that machine requires.
When people are in their bliss and doing what they would naturally be doing if they had all their needs met, you know, and they're just having fun, they're playing, what they create actually benefits not just them, but the whole.
It's our light, not our darkness, that scares us the most. We have enormous power to make life wonderful. And there's nothing we enjoy doing more than exercising that power.
If what we're really on this earth to do is to spin straw into gold, it's really finally to be creative and to give that to the culture, then in order to do that, you can't be living somebody else's life.
If we choose to do what we love, our lives get better. If we choose to share it with others, the lives of those around us get better. If enough of us do this, the world gets better.
We are most free when we are most bound to others.
We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical. Our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness.
This is a beautiful day. It is a new day.
Without these qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost.
This is a beautiful day. It is a new day.
The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together.
We are together.
The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men.
We are unified. We are together.
cries out for universal brotherhood and the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world.
Power! Upon you got power!
Millions of despairing men, women, and little children.
We are together!
Victims of a system that makes men torture.
They're playing in a paratactic space as full entities. Under those conditions, what might be a characteristic relationship among humans? Persons deemed to have had a lively capacity. So to weaken the distinctions between themselves or among themselves. That they could come to feel
we are unified, we are together,
that they were each other. Oh, perhaps sometime in your fifth or sixth decade you might have a mask made for you in which the faces of all the members of your clan are painted or inside. You wear the mask and you are they. You are all of them. Fusion, it's a term that's often used in microbiology. In connection with the outer surface of plasma membranes. When cells are healthy, they have regions of fusion on them. And if they didn't, we would be very dissipated indeed. Suggesting that received holes, what we are told are holes, are actually halves.
Power, you ain't playing power, you're in the wrong place.
And that it's a very important matter to see something that we are told is a whole thing and know that it's happening. We might be halves. We might be halves. We might be halves.
Brothers and sisters, the name of the game is power. You ain't playing power, you're in the wrong place. Brothers and sisters,
victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress.
We are together. We are unified.
The hate of men will pass.
We are together.
And dictators die. And the power they took from the people will return to the people.
We are together.
In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power. The power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power. To make this life free and beautiful. Free and beautiful. Free and beautiful. To make this life a wonderful adventure. Wonderful adventure. And in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite.
It's an open question. Is love more powerful than fear in human society? I think the result, if there is one, will be the result of everyone's individual facing up to that question. Are they going to be manipulated by fear, or are they going to respond to love? The metaphor of the matrix is a helpful one. People are used by a larger social machine for what it can get out of them, and by the millions are cast aside when it no longer serves the machine's purposes.
Another metaphor I've used is that of the Truman Show. Life in the so-called developed world is materially comfortable. Materially, you could say it's advantaged. But in another important sense, it's not free, because information is so highly controlled, because activity is so highly circumscribed, and because there are barriers erected which attempt to divide and conquer people, both within populations and within individuals.
I don't wish to separate the developed from the undeveloped world. I don't believe we can let our superficial differences divide us. Every one of us, wherever we are in the world, on a deep level, is suffering from the same misconceptions about the world in which we live. Is the mental and spiritual challenge of rethinking what it means to be a human and coming together as what might be termed a superorganism? Is that so hard that it'll take generations? Or could we see a world of peace and plenty by 2020? I believe the choice is up to us.
Not my good pony, and you give me your best. For you know and I know.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from the Unwelcome Guests archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. I've pretty much said everything that I feel really capable of saying at this point, so I don't know if I'll make another show. In any case, I always appreciate hearing feedback on the show, and this episode even more so. If you want to leave a public message, there's a wiki at unwelcomeguests.net/750 for discussion of the themes. If you'd like to send me a private email, I'm emailable, robin2020@altruists.org.
Be riding my shiny black.
Any kind of injustice, be it local or global, and study it and analyze it and see how it's a microcosm of a bigger picture. There is always something we can do that everybody can do.
Now, I've said it before, but it bears repeating, just what an encouragement my mum was to me. Drawing inspiration from that, if you feel bemused as to what to do, if you feel you have nothing to give, well, if you're listening to me, you have attention. Don't underestimate how important a gift of attention could be to those closest to you.
For a long time I'd been feeling that the world wasn't as it should be, and suddenly it all made sense.
And what has been shocked here is our beliefs and what this country is about. It's frightening, but at the same time more comforting to see the problem as coming from the outside than to search for it with amongst ourselves and within ourselves.
The chaos in the world around us is a reflection of the inharmony within us. In the final analysis, only as we become more peaceful people will we find ourselves living in a more peaceful world.
We can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together.
both inner and outer, forever in peace.